Hey everybody, Gregory Conley here with another edition of the Your Video Store Shelf podcast. Today is Saturday, May 12th, and on here on the East Coast, it is 3:27 in the afternoon. Meanwhile, our guest today, he's in Hawaii, and it is 9 a.m. over there. He is on his second cup of tea, and the man that we are speaking to, LA Weekly, recently identified him as being part of the Grindhouse Gang, because not only is he quite the director, but he is one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite all-time directors. And he is in Hawaii prepping for his next film about a killer Tyrannosaurus Rex, if I remember correctly. Brian Trenchard-Smith, 35-year industry veteran. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you, Greg. It's great to be in Hawaii. It's great to be preparing a movie, particularly one about a giant animal. I'm rather fond of giant animals. It's going to be my homage to Valley of Guanji, which by coincidence was one of the films that came through the trailer-making company where I was the junior writer-producer of trailers. I was the junior of four back in 1968, 69, 70, and Valley of Guanji came through the shop, and I assisted in the making of that trailer and got a first-hand look at the work of Ray Harryhausen in the raw, because some effects were not finished and had to be dropped in later. But that was great to see that, and then ultimately, 2 years ago, to actually meet Ray Harryhausen and tell him what an inspiration he was for me. Anyway, here I am doing with digital effects what Ray Harryhausen did with stop-motion photography. And so it will be fun. Tyrannosaurus Azteca, or Jurassic Park Eats Cortez. That's my private name for it.
You seem to have private names for a lot of your movies from talking to you in the past.
Yes. Well, I always think of... I'm fond of genre hybrids or genre cocktails, and so I always think, I look at a script, either one that I've been writing or co-writing or just devising the concept for, and I think of it in terms of the chemical balance of its genre elements. And the moment I read Tyrannosaurus Azteca, written by Richard Manning, a fine writer who wrote many episodes of Farscape, I just immediately thought, Jurassic Park eats Cortez, though Cortez has to survive to rape and pillage Mexico on a future expedition. This is the untold story of his scouting expedition. I thought that was the right way to describe it. Although we only have one prehistoric monster, we have two T-Rexes, the last male and female T-Rexes apparently left in the valley, but, well, as you'll find, they do have eggs. So, who knows?
And is there some kind of crazy scientist who wants them to actually mate?
Oh, no. This is... Cortez comes to Mexico on a scouting expedition 2 years before his famed expedition in 1534, I think. And he only has a few men with him, they encounter a tribe of Aztecs who have been taught Spanish by a priest who was shipwrecked on the coast, and so they are able to communicate. And much mayhem takes place, and Cortez, loses all but one of the men that he came with. So, anyway, I don't think I've spoiled the story particularly, because people who like these kind of movies, they kind of know the form, and they then expect the set pieces that go, with the formula.
You've mentioned in the past that for a lot of your movies, you have to love the genre to truly love the movies that you make. And after watching a few of your movies, I can totally see how that quote goes, and I've started to kind of apply that to certain movies as I watch them.
Hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, the reason that genre exists, you know, is that people want to see certain cinematic forms over and over again with new wrinkles and surprises, developments, bigger, better, etc. But, you know, the Western, the war movie, the spy thriller, the monster movie, they are the meat and potatoes of the broad cinema audience's diet. And, you know, I also like a little bit of refined food from time to time and enjoy a good French film and, films of all nationalities. I do see, you know, quite a lot of foreign films. Films that, let's say, have more intellectual heft. That's great. I have a very varied diet. If there's a film in one of my many favorite genres that comes out either in the theater or on DVD, I will rent it. I will see it. It has to be fairly disappointing for me to hit the fast forward button. And in general, if I go to the movies and pay $10 to see a film, I don't walk out. I guess I have a slightly sort of schizoid mind, and half of me is involved in the story and the characters and enjoying the drama playing out, and the other half is analyzing how it's done, either successfully or unsuccessfully. So I always find, even in the worst film, something to enjoy. So that generally keeps me there. But I must say, the fast forward button on DVD is also sometimes a blessing. Just get through a few more movies in a night that way.
My usual strategy is that if I know that I'm sitting down with a real clunker, or if I just discover that a movie is a clunker going along, thankfully the computer DVD player, 2 times fast forward, it just speeds up the dialogue. And especially if they have subtitles, God, you can watch a movie in a half hour and never have to think about it again.
That's right. Well, you know, I sometimes think that there is ultimately going to be a market for movies, old movies, and particularly genre movies, which have been reduced effectively to 20 minutes, 10 minutes, so that they become expanded trailers in a way. And the entire story is told, all the major character beats, all the action, suspense, horror, comedy, set pieces, whatever, are all there. But as we are seeing a shrinkage of the attention span worldwide, that started with MTV and now continues with people watching a DVD with their finger on a fast forward button and probably also sort of on the cell phone and maybe playing a computer game at the same time, because you often see that when you hang around and get young people, they're sort of multitasking in their recreational activities. But people now want they want the good bits compressed and quicker. I could go through a whole lot of interesting sort of 1950s westerns, for instance, and instead of having to see them at 90 minutes, or in the case of some of those lower budget but interesting movies, the Randolph Scott, they were 70 minute movies. You could with clever editing, you could reduce them to 15 to 20 minutes and still play out the whole story. And it's kind of like having a sandwich rather than a full course meal.
Is there a movie of yours in particular that you think would make a hearty sandwich?
Well, I think, directors often don't like to admit this, but every movie could be shorter. Certainly Spider-Man 3 could be shorter, but I did enjoy it, but it could be shorter. My attention was held and I admired lots of it, but it could be shorter. But the yeah, I'd say every film of mine could be reduced in length. There's a my very first film, which had it's certainly one that Tarantino likes. It's called The Man from Hong Kong. It was 106 minutes, and it did you haven't have a huge amount of action in it, but I could get my scissors into it now and certainly knock it back to 80 minutes without losing anything. So I could just, I could pace it up. People want, people want more pace now. And Britannic, I could certainly, my sort of poor man's Titanic made on James Cameron's, catering budget, that could certainly, I could reduce that to an hour from its present 90 minutes. I mean, I think it, for some, it plays perfectly okay at 90 minutes, but, everything could be shorter. I've made 120 trailers for movies, and maybe 30 plus, promo reels for movies that were still being, that maybe just finished shooting, in some cases were still shooting. And these reels would be shown at Cannes or the American Film Market or MIFED or whatever. So I have had a lot of expertise in, or experience, let's say, in reducing a movie to 2.5 minutes or to 10 minutes. So that's which is where I'm coming from when I said that these sort of Reader's Digest versions of old movies, where you still remember for the good parts and you just like to see all of those again rather than see the whole movie. That's where I'm coming from, I suppose. Everything can be shorter.
I see. And did you get your start in the business cutting trailers?
Yes. I mean, I started initially as a news film cutter for Channel 10 in Sydney. I was born and educated in England. I had a spell in Libya when I was a child. My father was in the Air Force, but he was Australian. He was in the British Air Force. But I came out to the land of Australia as I turned 20 because I felt I might have a better chance in the film industry there because they didn't have one. Whereas Britain's film industry was somewhat, it was run as a closed shop by the British Film Union at the time, so you couldn't get a job in the business without being a member of the union, and you couldn't get into the union without being offered a job. catch 22. So I took a ship to Australia and was working within 3 weeks as a news cutter for Channel 10, and then I volunteered to do the station promos, which I thought were a little limp, and they said, oh, well, okay. In those days, back in the Stone Age, before most of the people listening to this broadcast were born, if you, in Australia, the land of opportunity, if you volunteered to do something and said you could do it, you were given a shot, and hopefully you succeeded. So I did make some station promos that people liked. I mean, I actually made promos for the original television series of Mission Impossible. So it was a pleasure when I eventually got to direct TV episodes of the new Mission Impossible in the late 80s. Those promos were spotted by Channel 9, who stole me. I did the new season's launch for them just at the beginning of 1968 and end of 67, 68. So I launched the Australian version I launched Star Trek, Ironside, The Champions, Randall and Hopkirk deceased, Judd for the Defense, shows like that, and I came up with a more dynamic way of doing it, just using cutting images to music rather than showing dialogue extracts. This is not a particularly original idea now, but it seems to be then. So that was quite successful. They won the ratings hands down. And they were so grateful that I said, I have to travel. I have to go overseas and expand myself. And they gave me a reel of my stuff, which is kind of them. And I showed it both in Japan and Hawaii and America in the course of a five-month, on a shoestring budget expedition to try and learn more. I learned more about color television, for instance. I learned about chroma key effects. So everywhere I could blunder in and say, hey, I'd love to hang out here, then they let me. An American company, National Screen Service, met me and said, you know, we've actually got a slot open in London for the junior writer-producer of trailers, and National Screen makes 70% of the English language movie trailers that are made in Europe, as well as a lot in America. So I was on my way to England and duly got that job and had a few years making trailers for Hammer Horrors, very diverse slate. They tend to give me the things they didn't think were particularly important. I was told to go to a screening theater and take a look at this new spaghetti western that had come in, and it was the Italian version, do something with that. So I sat down and found I was seeing Once Upon a Time in the West in the Italian language without subtitles, and the three-hour version.
Oh.
Wow, what an experience. I had no idea what I was about to see. 9 o'clock at the Trident Theater on Wardour Street. I thought by about 2.5 hours I was busting to take a leak. But it was so involving. My Italian is pretty limited to Italian opera and what I can remember of studying Latin for 8 years. But I had to see the end. But that was the full sort of 3-hour version. So I made the trailer for that, and occasionally made trailers for sort of art movies like Lindsay Anderson's If, which if you've ever seen is certainly a very interesting portrait of an English public school. Partly based on the one that I went to, according to the writer. So those trailers were a great education, and I got to meet a lot of filmmakers at the screenings of the cut that I would be working on. But eventually the Australians called me back and said, please come back and run the network promos and for 5 stations. And I said, I will if you let me make programs as well. And that's how I was able to make the transition from being a promo and trailer maker to directing. So I was self-taught, no film school other than my own private one of just going to movies and watching television constantly and absorbing. I volunteered. I said, I can do this. And people said, fine. So I learned which direction to point the camera. And the rudiments of editing was certainly well in my head after all that editing of trailers, and editing being the grammar and syntax of filmmaking. So luckily I was able to initially direct film sequences for beauty pageants and then work my way up to full-scale dramatized documentaries and made my first run for the network in 1972. It was called For Valor, and it reenacted the circumstances that caused 4 Australian soldiers in Vietnam to win the Victoria Cross, which is the highest award for gallantry in the British and Commonwealth Army. And that kind of launched me. I went independent and started making more dramatized documentaries, and then that got me my first feature, The Man from Hong Kong, which was a sort of spoof of Bruce Lee meets James Bond. James Bond's a master criminal, in fact. And I was going to satirize the kung fu genre and celebrate it, too. The concept of the crypto-fascist superhero who causes an appalling amount of destruction in the cause of justice. Luckily I was able to get it financed as a co-production between a Hong Kong company and my Australian company. And the film was a big success sales-wise, though it was derided somewhat by the critics in Australia who didn't get its sense of humor. But it's a perennial, it's still out there, you can get it from Hong Kong Flicks. though, you know, well, there's many a story attached to that, but I'm not getting my share, shall we say. But so the main thing is that your film gets seen and enjoyed by an audience. I get a great buzz out of the films of mine that when I've sat with an audience, a paying audience, and seen them laugh and gasp in all the right places, and that's you know a great reward for a filmmaker. But that's the long version of how I got started from, let's say, an aspiring kid who wanted to make movies and made 8mm films at school, to actually getting a shot at a film that ended up in the theaters of the world. And now I'm making my 37th film, many of which no one has heard of except for a very loyal band. And I made 35 episodes of television, and the main thing is just to keep practicing your craft, because you never stop learning, and you can always find ways of being either more creative or more efficient.
Unfortunately, prior to about a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I was not a member of the loyal band of Brian Trenchard Smith followers. But one night, I believe it was, I rewatched Leprechaun 4.
Well, I hope you were in a state of altered consciousness at the time. Sometimes
of course. And Omega Code 2. And your DC 9/11 film, and even though those probably they may not be your favorite films, they sure had a Brian Trenchard Smith sense of sensibility of sorts.
Yeah, no doubt.
And all three, they worked for what they were. And I know that there's a very interesting story that people probably don't know behind Leprechaun 4, which is the one that takes the Leprechaun in space.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a fun film. But are you referring to how I got it? How I got Trimark to green light it?
Yeah, the Apollo 13 spoof, I believe it was.
Well, yes, they at a Christmas party at Trimark, they'd made the first three Leprechaun movies, and I'd done number three, which is Leprechaun in Vegas, which some people prefer to number four. Number four is a more out there pastiche of genre parody, but at this Christmas party they created a poster that was very similar to the Apollo 13 poster, and they had a leprechaun in a spacesuit, and the line was Houston, we have a problem, and everyone thought that was funny, and they thought, well, maybe that's the way to go with the next Leprechaun movie, because number three, the one that I'd made, became the highest-selling direct-to-video of 1995. They came to me, and I said, well, that's okay, but frankly, I think you're better off with not Apollo 13, but taking the Alien Matrix having a bunch of space marines hunting a creature, but the creature is a leprechaun. Who, for various reasons, is after his gold. He's always after his gold. They thought, okay, well, come and tell us about the best scenes in the film. I had obviously some in mind. I said, well, if it's an Aliens type of movie, then you've got to have a kind of a chest burster scene. I have a rather sort of unique wrinkle on that, let's say, and that's supposing somehow the leprechaun is they corner him, he gets blown to pieces, one of the space marines decides to unzip his pants and piss on a body part just as a gesture of contempt, and I'll do this angle behind the guy peeing, and you'll see the sort of the urine stream, suddenly a little green blip will run back up it and go whoop, and this guy will go, oh God, what was that? There was some, I think, VD joke that was made at that point. Anyway, I'm telling this as much as I'm telling it to you, and this group of executives and the head of the company, Mark Amin, is sitting at the end of the table, and the group of executives who brought me in to pitch this to the boss. I'm carrying on like this, and I'm looking at their faces, and you know, I kind of feel they're going white because they suddenly think, "Oh my God, what have we brought in the room?" because they didn't quite get me. And so I said, "So later, you know, this is going to pay off because this Marine and a lady Space Marine go into one of a dark corner of the spaceship to get it on, and you know she's got her hand in his pants, and he's saying, 'Not so rough. You don't want to take it home with you, do you?'" And and she can't understand what he's going on about because she never gets this kind of complaint normally. And I think teeth are clenching sort of around the table. But I'm rabbiting on, and nothing's going to stop me. Suddenly the Marine, doubles up in pain, sinks to the floor, and his pants start to bulge furiously. And then suddenly, with a great cry of pain, his pants split open, and the leprechaun flies out of his pants, lands on the ground nearby, turns to them and said, "Next time, me lad, you should wear a prophylactic." And then I sort of rested my case. They're all looking at me aghast, and the boss thinking, "Oh my God, we're going to be in trouble for this." And the boss is sitting at the end of the table, and he says, he's silent for a moment, he says, "So, the leprechaun comes out of the man's penis." I like it! And suddenly, the whole table erupts in congratulation from looking at me as if, I was a leper that had crawled into the room without permission. I suddenly became the hero of the hour. "Yes, isn't it wonderful? It's a great idea. Oh, we love it. We love it." And I said, frankly, anyone who sees that scene, they will be talking about it in the schoolyard, because that's really where it's aimed. They'll be talking about it in the schoolyard on the next morning. So the film's greenlit for $1.6 million in 18 main unit days and 2 second unit days. We made, a fairly wacky film that came out of my id, written by my writing partner, Dennis Pratt. We collaborate on a lot of things. You either think, or if you read the IMDb correspondence, all these wannabe critics who, slam filmmakers and have no idea what difficulties go into making films, let alone zero budget films. So there are people who revile it, and there are those that think it's the funniest thing they've ever seen. Certainly, a state of altered consciousness and a group around the screen helps. Chug a few beers, whatever. Everywhere I could put a piece of science fiction parody or reference, I would. And so we've got Land of the Giants, when the leprechaun grows to 30 feet. We've got a mad scientist who gets turned into a sort of a spider hybrid and is hungry for flies. Wonderful British actor Guy Siner, who's in Hello, Hello, doing a great job. We have all sorts of things that are referenced there, and we have a leprechaun who speaks Shakespeare, quotes from Richard III and Henry the Fifth Part One, I think. We have as much fun with sidebar references as we can for, basically the geek squad that I secretly play to out there who enjoy a film. On the one hand, is following genre form, but on the other hand is mildly poking fun at the concepts that you know regularly occur in these films. And one in particular, I mean, obviously, in these kinds of pictures, the distributors would require there be a scene, a topless scene. Some girl has to, you know, bare her breasts. And I thought, well, I said to Dennis, what is the most absurd way, what's the most absurd excuse we could possibly come up with for a girl to bare her breasts in this film? So we thought, okay, well, on her planet, I mean, she's a princess, and quite a princess, too, as you see. If the member of the royal family bares her breasts to you, it is a death sentence. That's their way of conveying a death sentence. And I thought, oh, that's great. I like that. And so I was able to persuade the plucky Rebecca Carlton to shed her top proudly. Naturally, only one of our Marines understands what this gesture means, that they are in fact in deep shit because of what she has done, whereas Miguel Nunez Jr., who plays one of the Marines, is licking his lips and thinking, wow, there may be some prospect for this lady, but no. So often in my stuff, rarely as overtly as in Leprechaun in Space, I'm able to have a few sly digs at the conventions and the underpinnings of those conventions that regularly occur in genre films.
And have you gotten, did you ever get the chance to check out the two films that followed your Leprechaun in Space film, which transferred Warwick Davis from space into the hood?
You know, honestly, and I suppose this is a gap in my education, I haven't seen them. There was talk briefly of my doing a Leprechaun in the Hood picture, but I felt that it would be wrong for a white director who has a strong involvement in the script to be poking fun at black culture. I think that's something that a black director should be doing. I just was not interested in doing. I had a concept for the next Leprechaun movie, but it was not Leprechaun in the Hood. It was Leprechaun in the White House. And it would follow on from Leprechaun in Space, where you have a picture of the White House, or a shot of the White House, and suddenly the big Independence Day spaceship suddenly looms overhead. And instead of blowing the White House to pieces, a little sort of ray comes down and it spits down a block of ice. And in the block of ice is the Leprechaun, and it melts, and he gets into the the air conditioning ducts and whatever of the White House, and learns by overhearing, that there is a thing called Fort Knox, and all the nation's gold is in it. So that gives him his gold, his quest for gold. But the White House is somewhat sort of dysfunctional insofar as there's a brilliant president with a bit of a zipper problem, and some interesting dynamics within the family, let's say, a daughter. But I was not going to make fun of Chelsea in a bad way. And of course, evil Republicans, endeavoring to take over by hook or by crook. And somehow it all gets put right because of the Leprechaun's greed. He somehow manages to save America from the fate that it's currently in. That was my concept, but they thought that was that was just too way out. 18.
The leprechaun in space taking over a man with a metal plate in his head and making him dance, that's okay, but the leprechaun in the White House, that's absurd.
I know. I mean, yeah, what can I say? But so it was actually with some amusement that 18 months after I had pitched the idea as the leprechaun movie I would be prepared to make next, the Monica Lewinsky affair broke. And a few months into that, as it started to become a total media football, I called the head of Trimark and put a message on his voicemail saying, remember that idea I pitched to you about Leprechaun in the White House 18 months ago, just about? Wouldn't you like to have had that movie ready for release right now?
Oh, exactly what I was thinking.
I never got a reply. But executives have a hard time. Yeah, they are. Yeah, it's people are throwing so many ideas at them, and some ideas are more dangerous than others. And that just seemed to be. It seemed to be an idea that would. They didn't think that the genre audience would be. Well, they didn't think the political satire was going to work for the Leprechaun audience, and I think when they looked at Leprechaun in Space, it had its balance of comedy was far heavily weighted against its balance of horror, and they felt that was possibly a mistake, and it only sold 40,000 units as opposed to 55,000, which number three had sold. So. My more overtly comedic approach seemed to be, was slightly discredited in that regard. So obviously there's a lot of, I think there must be a lot of comedy in the Hood pictures, but I just haven't checked them out. I mean, I sometimes you move on. I feel I saw the first two Leprechauns. I thought, I'd rather make this guy funny, because he's not really scary. So let's make him more funny, I took it as far as I was able to, and then it was time to do another genre.
Well, the money in the Leprechaun in the Hood movies is pretty much in the fifth one. The dialogue between Warwick Davis and Ice-T is phenomenal, and especially when they get to the point where I believe Ice shares a joint with the leprechaun.
Yes, I believe that happens. That's right. And that's funny, is it? That's a great scene. I will definitely check it out. I will have to see that.
And before we sign off for the day, earlier we were talking about you having your pet names of sorts for some of your movies. And we never got to hear any others that you've had in the past. And well, one movie in particular that I've talked about on this show, Storm Effect, a Region Entertainment movie that you were a creative consultant on. You had a very special name for that flick.
Well, after doing what, in Her Line of Fire, otherwise in the straight version of the film known as Air Force Two, but In Her Line of Fire was Lesbian Rambo to me. I thought, well, I'd love to do another lesbian movie for you, what about, and they were saying, give us a disaster movie, come on, we need another disaster movie, and I thought, well, what about Lesbian Nuclear Hurricane, I would make that movie just to have the t-shirt. I knew that the title ultimately would not fly, but we'd certainly make the t-shirt. It's been retitled, and I think it's called Storm Effects, and Fred Olen Ray has directed it, but I developed the script, I'm sure I'm looking forward to seeing it when I get back to LA, and Regent, I'm sure, will show it to me. It's possible my next picture will be for them after this. I don't know. It'll either be another creature feature or it'll be a submarine picture. But just in terms of the original question about genre cocktail titles, I mean, Megiddo, Omega Code 2, was, you know, I said, and I did a lot of work on the script to make it more fit certain genre patterns, and I said, this is, you know, this is basically The Omen meets Air Force One in the end of days, and they fight the Battle of the Bulge and are rewarded by the Second Coming. I mean, you know, what's not to like? So once you sort of define, you know, the ingredients of your genre cocktail, then you can go for it. And certainly, you know, there are influences from all those titles, and homages, shall we say, to all those titles in Megiddo, Omega Code 2. And it's a film that plays very well for the Pentecostal community who take it very seriously, and it also plays well for the secular community who perhaps take it less seriously. I think Harry Knowles kind of got it in a way, though. I don't think he knows about me or I don't think he gets me, or I don't know, maybe he does. I don't have anything, I've never spoken to him or really read his column very often, but he did a piece on the film, thinking obviously that we intended, or that I intended, the whole thing to be taken deathly seriously. Well, no, it's meant to work for two audiences, one of whom has a sense of humor. But he talked about Michael York's extravagantly over-the-top performance. Well, this was not an accident. This was deliberate. And Michael and I had huge fun just sticking lines of Shakespeare and biblical quotes into the dialogue, because the devil should have the best lines.
And Michael was awesome in that movie.
He's just utterly magnificent. He's a wonderful actor, I love him. He really gave it that special quality that pointed up, you know, perhaps some of the absurdities in this kind of storytelling. I mean, I made it in the style of some of those grandiose, you know, 50s and early 60s biblical epics with, you know, somewhat heavy and portentous, that seemed to be the way, you know, a style to apply to the scenes that, let's say, were not either in Air Force One in End of Days or Battle of the Bulge. I think it's huge fun. It should be seen by an eclectic audience, probably of mainly young people who perhaps don't believe in a vengeful God. They can have a lot of fun deconstructing it. But at the same time, the Pentecostals, they see it as the truth of what will happen. In allegorical form, but, you know, the end of days is coming, times of tribulation is coming, and a lot of people are saying things that are going on in the world right now are indicative of that, and, you know, the rapture's around the corner. Frankly, that's a little scary, but...
Because God knows the world's never had war and terrorist attacks before. This is the first time ever.
We're seeing an interesting transition in the world at the moment, and I'm an eternal optimist, and I think you have to be as a low-budget filmmaker. So I don't think the world is going to go to hell in a handbasket. We're going to come close to the brink, but I think we will pull back just in time. And I liken the development of the planet to, we're at the stage of our late teenage years, where we are being highly self-destructive, and, you know, we are so confused by so many things that we, you know, depression is anger turned inward. We're doing a whole bunch of stuff to ourselves and each other and the planet in general, which is the product of, you know, let's say immaturity in terms of our growth as a species, and I believe we will pull back from the brink and we will, you know, find a better way to share the planet's resources with each other, regardless of race or creed or color, and we will somehow stop poisoning the planet before it shrugs us off its back. So I believe that is our future. My one moment of seriousness in this entire conversation, but I think that's our future, and I hope and pray that my children will see that and not see the continuing spiral into, you know, corporate greed, corporate fascism, the thought police, and the poisoning of the environment for the enrichment of a few. So I believe we will somehow, be able to rein in this runaway horse and come to a more equitable way of living together and preserving the wonderful garden that we could all be, you know, living in if we just were a little less selfish and more compassionate to our fellow man and more sensible. Because I'm on a beautiful part of the world in Hawaii right now, and I'm seeing I'm in the Garden of Eden, beautiful, you know, jungles and nice creatures. Apart from the one that I'm creating, but really, actually, T-Rexes were actually vegetarians, you know. But we won't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
And you just know that the IMDb kids are going to be all over that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But when you find yourself every day amidst, you know, literally in a Garden of Eden, it just brings you face to face with what the priorities really should be, which is, you know, being in harmony with the environment. It's not that I'm a rampant tree hugger or anything like that. I hug the occasional tree, but it's just you have to come to a quiet place and see, you know, that it's not just there's more to life than the high-pressure consumer society that we are all living in at the moment. You know, work, consume, be silent, die, or preferably reproduce before you die, reproduce more consumers. Capitalism is fine. Unrestrained capitalism is dangerous. There's got to be a balance. And hopefully we're going to find it. And the next election is critically important. That everyone get out and vote. Hopefully it will be an honest election, or as honest as is possible. And we will be able to, you know, turn the tide back from the current path that we seem to be on.
Well, on that serious note, which is a phrase that, well, has never been spoken before on the Your Video Store Shelf podcast, and chances are never will, Brian, I want to thank you for doing the show. This was supposed to be 15 minutes, but thankfully the lines in Hawaii, the phone lines are peaceful on this Saturday morning, so the reception was perfect, and this interview went very well. I hope the filming of Tyrannosaurus Azteca goes the same.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I look forward to talking about it when it's done.
You said you'd be back in the States at the end of June, correct?
End of June, yes. Yeah.
Great. Well, we know when we'll get you back on.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Sounds good. And, well, in the meantime, those interested in Brian Trenchard-Smith can check out any number of films that are going to be linked on the IMDb. His many people claim the best Siege of Fire-based glory is out there, and then you also have the likes of Night of the Demons 2, the two Leprechaun movies he did, most recently in video stores, the lesbian Rambo movie, In Her Line of Fire.
Has that actually hit the stores, the lesbian version yet? Is that actually out? I know...
I rented it from Blockbuster Online, I believe.
Oh.
And it was indeed, did feature the lesbian love.
Oh, we the two kisses are there. It's such an innocent movie, really. You know, but I'm afraid the rest of the world, the Air Force 2 version has been shorn of its lesbian kisses. But there's plenty of lesbian subtext, so yeah.
And that is also another damn fine film. If you are a person who enjoys the, I don't know how you would describe it, the Rambo type film,
yeah,
I guess, Rambo genre.
It was kind of a sort of, it was an homage to 1980s gun porn Rambo kind of movies with a woman firing the weapon in all directions and mowing down hundreds of hapless indigenous peoples. But it was, again, it's a genre cocktail, but Marielle Hemingway is great in the part, and Jill Bennett is wonderful as the girl who's secretly in love with her but doesn't realize it until they kiss. Its greatest claim to fame is the fact that it was shot in 14 days. And for those of you out there who have an understanding of low-budget filmmaking, then that is, I'm proud to have made the film, not only because the gay and lesbian films that I've made are a plea for tolerance in genre form, saying that, heroes, brave people can be gay and lesbian. It's got absolutely nothing to do, their genetic programming of their sexual orientation has got nothing to do with their character. So that's why we have Adrian Paul playing a gay submarine commander in Tides of War, as opposed to the Phantom Below version, which is the straight version of the film. And the two versions have to be made so that the thing can be economically viable, because the gay versions have a much smaller market. So investors are entitled to recoup their money. I don't see any shame in making a straight version for the less tolerant markets, because it allows the film to be made in the first place. So I'm proud to have made those, let's say, for political reasons. But they're also examples of low budget ingenuity. And In Her Line of Fire has a hell of a lot of bang for the buck for a 14-day shoot, 12 days in New Zealand and 2 days in Canada. So there. Okay.
And we'll talk more about the likes of gun porn, lesbianism, and genre cocktails when we get you on at the end of June. Good luck with the Tyrannosaurus movie. Brian, thank you once again for joining me on this lovely Saturday afternoon when you could be exploring Hawaii.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and we will get you on again. This is Gregory Connolly with the Your Video Store Shelf podcast saying thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again soon. See ya.